And hello and welcome to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM. We're broadcasting from the University of California, Irvine campus, and we're on the web at kuci.org. We're also on iTunes at College Radio. Today is Wednesday, April 6, 2016. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett, and my guests today are Dawn Tripp and Christopher Sorrentino. First up is Dawn Tripp. Winner of the Massachusetts Book Award for Fiction, Dawn Tripp is the author of the novels Moontide, The Season of Open Water, and Game of Secrets, a Boston Globe bestseller. Her essays have appeared in the Virginia Quarterly Review, The Believer, The Rumpus, Psychology Today, and NPR. She graduated from Harvard and lives in Massachusetts with her family, and she's here today to talk about her fourth novel, Georgia, about the American artist Georgia O'Keeffe. Hi, Dawn.
Hi, how are you?
Great. Great to have you.
I'm thrilled to be here. Thanks so much for having me.
Oh, of course. Love the book. Just loved it. And I should say one reason I initially found the novel so compelling is because I learned of O'Keeffe through studying photography years and years ago. We got into Stieglitz and in
right.
his work and seeing those early photos of her before learning anything about her. So I found it really interesting to read it from sort of the other point of view of her.
Right.
I'd love to hear you talk about what inspired you to write Georgia.
You know, well, I was born in 1968, and that was the year that a photograph, a portrait of Georgia O'Keeffe was on the cover of Life magazine. You know, and she was in her 80s, wrapped in her black with that, marked, gorgeous, lined beauty in her face. And, of an older woman who is so self-possessed and knows exactly who she is and what she, wants. And there was a, her desert was spread out behind her. And that was the image of O'Keeffe that I grew up with, and she, to me, she was, a kind of role model, a woman who had, made certain definitive choices in her life to make art on her own terms and build a life in a landscape that she loved. But I knew nothing about her New York years with Stieglitz. And, I knew her representational art, but I knew nothing about her abstractions and the range and scope of her abstractions until in 2009 I saw an exhibit of those abstractions at the Whitney Museum of American Art paired with the photographs that Stieglitz had taken of her in the early 20s. And, that show for me was a revelation. And I couldn't escape the feeling that here's a woman that I thought I knew. Here's a woman that we all know of, and yet on some level, barely know at all.
Interesting. So I know you've written three other novels. I'm really compelled to read them because I love this one so much. Have you in the past based any of your books on historical figures or real situations?
They've been based on real situations, but not on historical figures. So this was a departure for me. And they've also, my earlier works were written third-person, shifting point of view. And with this novel, I chose, I wanted to stay close to the facts. I wanted to, write a story about key events in O'Keeffe's life, specifically between 1917 to 1933, her New York life. And I wanted it only peopled by real-life situations and characters. But I wanted to get into her head. I wanted it to be first-person, an imagined point of view, because I felt like that first person would allow me to get right, right up against, what she might have felt and thought and questioned during that period of time, what she loved and feared and fought for and dreamed. And I wanted to bring that inside world to life.
And also, it's in the present tense.
Yes.
Which is, I think it's rather difficult to write an entire novel in present tense and really sort of be in it and keep the reader in it.
I believe in voice. Like, voice for me is the driving force of a novel as a writer and also, as a reader. And so for me, it took me about a year to find the voice of this book. And when I found it, you know, when it came to me, I actually wasn't at my desk. I was outside with my two sons. And when it came to me, it came in the present tense. And, you know, once, you know, it was in me, that was really, there was no other, you know, choice. Like, that was the, you know, that was the driving voice of the novel.
Voice is such, I don't know, it can be so esoteric, talking about voice and trying to find the voice. And you say it took you a year. Can you talk a little bit about how you tried to find it?
How I tried to find it. Yeah, that's such a great question. I read biography after biography about O'Keefe and also about Stieglitz and about O'Keefe and Stieglitz. And I did not, in that first year of work, apart from the catalog from the Whitney Museum that had little excerpts from her letters, I stayed away from reading anything that was written in O'Keefe's voice, including her letters and including, you know, two memoirs that she wrote later on in her life, because I knew that until, you know, I needed to stay away from that material until I had found the voice of my novel, because that was the voice that was going to tell her story to me. But I looked at art. I looked at her art. I looked at Stieglitz's art, his photographs of her, and, you know, the range and scope of both of their art over time. I looked at the work of other artists in the Stieglitz circle, and I write in notebooks, so I wrote in my notebooks, and I would get glimpses of what I felt the voice, you know, could be or would be, but I couldn't quite nail it. And I find that with a novel, if I start writing too soon before I really have that voice in me, the book ultimately, it's not that it'll fail, but it will lack a certain life or heart. And I think that there's a lot of things that you can do with a book, but it's really hard to put that sense of life in it when it's not, you know, there, when you've, you know, you've moved into it too fast. And so I've just gotten in the habit of play, you know, and kind of writing, but writing around things or writing into things and, you know, kind of backing off or moving in again and, you know, experimenting with images and the way that she would look at the world or see the world or describe the world, you know, getting into her head. But I've learned also not to really write, you know, full steam ahead until that voice is really all the way in me.
Is that how it happened with your other novels as well? Just, you know, kind of searching, trying, meandering, and then one day there it is?
They were a little bit different because they were third person, shifting point of view. And so I feel like with a first person voice, it has to ring true. I mean, that's true with any voice, but with first person specifically, like, you can really feel it when it's not working. And I think particularly with O'Keefe, I was so struck when I did start to read her letters and her memoirs, how her memoirs that she wrote later on in her life, they were written first person, but they were almost removed. You know, it was almost like she was holding the world at arm's length in that first person voice. It's almost like they just had that remoteness that often comes in more in third. And I feel like with first, you know, you have this opportunity again to write about the immediacy of an experience, you know, to write into the depths of feeling and drive. Mm-hmm. And so I feel that particularly with first person, like, that really has to be, that has to be true.
Mm. Yeah, I can't imagine this in any other tense or point of view. It was so perfect. Just
thank you.
You just so nailed it. I'd love to hear you read from Georgia, would you?
I'd love to. And I will read from the beginning of the novel. The novel opens with her as an older woman in New Mexico. So 1979, Abiquiu, New Mexico.
All right.
I bought this house for the door. The house itself was a ruin, but I had to have that door. Over the years, I've painted it many times, all different ways. Abstract, representational, blue, black, brown. I've painted it in the hot green of summer, in the dead of winter, clouds rushing past it, a lone yellow leaf drifting down. I painted the door open only once, just before he died. In every picture after, it was closed. This is not a love story. If it were, we would have the same story. But he has his, and I have mine. He used to say it all began with the charcoal abstractions I made in 1915 before I met him. I was 27, a school teacher, poor, driven only by a singular, relentless passion for my art. One night I turned my back on everything I'd learned about what art should be. I locked the door of my room and got down on the floor with large sheets of paper and charcoal. I remember the cool hush of the night through the window as shapes poured out of the nub of charcoal in my hand. Finished, I rolled up the drawings and sent them to my friend Anita Politzer in New York. She brought them to Stieglitz at his gallery. When he saw them, he told her, "These are the purest, fairest, sincerest things that have entered 291 in a long while." I knew who he was. Everyone did. I'd met him once before, though he would not remember. The father of modern photography, an icon of American art. In groundbreaking shows at 291, Alfred Stieglitz had introduced New York to the work of Picasso and Matisse. A brilliant photographer in his own right, he was known more for the careers of the artists he'd made. I wrote to him at 291 and asked him to tell me what he saw in my charcoal drawings. He wrote back to say he wanted to show my work. I should send him more. We exchanged letters back and forth across the country. I spent every extra dollar on brushes, paper, paint. Over the years, this would be the story he told again and again until it became the story. Those charcoals, his discovery of me, our correspondence that began shortly after. He would say I was what he had been waiting for, what he had always known was meant to exist. Because Stieglitz used words with a certain unique force, his version of our story prevailed. "You will be a legend," he said to me once. I laughed. "No," he said, "I see it. It's already in you." Legend, a word he would use again and again. He had faith in me. He did not give me greatness, but his faith in my early work gave me the space to achieve it. He knew this then, and perhaps on some level he also knew that for me to fully become the legend he saw, I would have to leave him. Tonight in New Mexico, so many years later, the air is clear. My sight is gone, but I know this view by heart. The ropey silver turns of the road passing below my window, the shrubby heads of the cottonwoods, the river valley, the distant line of hills. The shapes of the world out there are shadowy, lean and contoured strokes they glow. The moon shines and cuts the night open. There's a grain of truth to Stieglitz's version of things. The story of my art in his life did begin the moment he unrolled those charcoals. But to my mind, our story began more than a year later. I was still teaching at a small college in Texas, sending him my pictures as I made them. A curious intimacy had begun to evolve in our letters. It was late May 1917 when Stieglitz wrote to say he had hung a small show of my watercolors and charcoals. My first show, it would be 291's last. He was closing the gallery, the war. I felt my heart skip as I read those lines, what I would give to see my things on those walls. For 3 days, I walked around with his letter in my pocket. Then I went to the bank manager's house on a Sunday and begged him to open so I could withdraw the last $200 I had to buy our train ticket from Texas to New York. I did not tell Stieglitz I was coming.
Wonderful. That was Dawn Tripp reading from Georgia, a novel of George O'Keefe published by Random House. Wow. Was that always the first chapter?
The very first chapter is a prologue, so actually that was always the first chapter of the main novel. But the prologue is one page italicized section at the very beginning that is O'Keefe addressing Stieglitz in second person. "I no longer love you as I once did," in the dazzling rush of those early days. And that actually was the first those were the first words that I had in her voice, was that second person address. And there was a sort of a visceral, you know, viscerality to it that felt so clean and undeniable to me as a writer. Mm-hmm. And that was when I knew that I had my door into the story.
Interesting. So, you know, there's, at least around here with my students and writer friends, there's quite a bit of controversy around prologues and whether we use them or not. And did you have any I don't know, second thoughts about that? Or it sounds like it was right there from the start and it had to be there and it helped you sort of get into the rest of the book.
It is. I mean, there are times when I have a passage that is one of my favorite passages in the novel that was for years. It was in the first 15 pages of the book, and it is now in the last 15 pages of the book. Mm-hmm. And it was like cutting myself open to move it. Like, it was so hard for me to extract that and move it to a different place in the novel. But once I moved it, it was so precise that was where it belonged, you know, at the end. But I feel that we have these pieces of early material, and they are our way in. And at a certain point for me with writing, you know, with a novel, I can distance myself from the book. I sometimes need to put it away for 3 to 4 months, and it's usually in a much later draft. It's usually often when it's already, you know, it's already moved into galleys, when I'm so distant that I can really look at it and I can read the book through and I can feel when anything is vastly out of place structurally. And also, we were talking earlier about voice, when the voice is off. And even this past fall, the fall of 2015, I went back through the novel and I made quite a number of changes between galleys and finished book to recast anything that didn't feel true to the voice of the novel. And that included writing one scene of her painting a particular picture. I rewrote it almost entirely, and that was after galleys.
Interesting. Yeah. Yeah, I love it. I mean, I love prologues when they work, and sometimes they're just absolutely necessary. And anyway,
when I set out to write the book, I was, my original intent when I was still looking for the voice, my original intent was only to have the younger O'Keefe, you know, to really only have O'Keefe in her New York life. I didn't have the frame of the older woman. But when the voice came to me, it was the voice of the older O'Keefe reflecting on that period of time that would be the period of time, the main story of the novel. And in retrospect, I can see that it had to be, there had to be that tension, you know, because our, for many, many people, including for me, my, that tension between the younger O'Keefe and the older O'Keefe, my first experience, my first apprehension of O'Keefe was O'Keefe as an older woman, and that tension between who she was then and who she becomes is such a driving force of tension in the novel, and it's also a driving, you know, the driving force of who she is in, you know, an American consciousness. Does that make sense?
Yeah, makes a lot of sense. No, it's there's so much to talk about. We have a few minutes, so perhaps when the paperback comes out, you will come out to California and be with us at the,
I would love that,
our speaker series. In the meantime, I am curious if, in writing this, or and even your other books that were based on situations, did you ever worry someone else might be writing a similar novel about her, or about, again, your past novels, situations? Or did you figure that yours would obviously be different and be your own, because who writes, you know, who writes the same book, no matter what the idea is?
You know, I feel that one of, and I have this great writer friend of mine, and we've had this conversation before, and we've talked about how once you publish, it's really important to remember how to get back alone in the room again.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel that that is something that I strive to do with every book, to get back alone when I'm just, it's just me alone with the work and not the kind of nagging questions of, you know, where will this fall in the marketplace? Will this be publishable? Will someone write a book like this first and therefore diminish the impact of mine? I just find that thoughts like that don't allow the process to be intuitive and organic. And for me as a writer, it has to be intuitive, organic for it to work well.
Yeah. The marketplace, it's so easy to let it in the room, isn't it?
Yeah. And you can think about it. I feel like I can think about it intellectually ahead of time, but once I'm in a story, deep in a story, I have to be in the world of that story. I have to be in this, you know, the stakes, the world, the needs, the parameters of that particular world. I have to be so fully present there in order to write well.
You have small children. Do you ever go away? Do you go on writer's residencies or rent a motel room to have that sort of quiet time?
Occasionally. I have an exceptionally supportive husband who is just not only, we're both self-employed, so we just make it work. You know, we just have such a positive, supportive, mutually supportive partnership. And I feel that that is just a gift. You know, that is just something that I never take for granted. So we will occasionally, there will be times when I'm traveling for work, either for promotion, you know, for a book that's out or for, you know, to be able to go away and just write. But I feel that what that relationship and what my marriage has actually allowed for is for the culture of our home to be supportive of my work, if that makes sense.
Sure.
So I actually feel that I have what I need in our home in terms of a really positive, supportive working environment.
Yeah, that's perfect. Every writer, every artist should have a relationship like that, right?
You know, I feel so incredibly lucky. He's also, you know, he reads all my work in its early drafts. You know, he knows my strengths, and he's a good reader. He's a really strong reader. He knows my strengths, my weaknesses. He knows when I haven't taken a risk. You know, so he'll respond to what's on the page, but he'll also respond to what's not there yet. You know, because I haven't been brave enough to do it. And he's also very direct. And so that has forced me to be more ruthless with my own work, you know, with my edits, you know, cutting back material that isn't serving the forward motion of the story. Because I don't always write in a linear way. You know, I'll compose often in a nonlinear way. But a reader experiences a novel in a linear way. I mean, a reader's reading from page 1 to page 320. So even if the narrative is moving back and forth in time or, you know, shifting from point of view to point of view, there still has to be that sense of a driving linear structure, if that makes sense. And he has a really keen sense of story that's just been so helpful to me in the process of revision.
Oh, we are at the end of our time. I am so glad to have this chance with you.
This is a joy. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Dawn. That was Dawn Tripp. Her novel is Georgia, a novel of Georgia O'Keeffe, published by Random House. Her website is dawntripp.com, 2 P's on Tripp. And just such an excellent, excellent novel. Oh, what can I say, except that I loved it, and hope some of you have a chance to take a look. Stay with us. When we return, we should have Christopher Sorrentino with us. Don't go away. And welcome back to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM in Irvine. We are broadcasting from the University of California, Irvine campus, and we're on the web at KUCI.org and on iTunes College Radio. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett. And during the first half, we had Dawn Tripp, author of Georgia On. We are back with Christopher Sorrentino. Christopher is the author of five books, including Trance, a National Book Award finalist for fiction. His work has been widely anthologized and has appeared in A Public Space, The Baffler, Bomb, Book Forum, Conjunctions, Esquire, McSweeney's, Playboy, Tin House, and many more. He's been the recipient of fellowships from the Lannan Foundation, the New York Foundation for the Arts, and the Ludwig Vogelstein Foundation, and he was writer-in-residence at Fairleigh Dickinson University in 2011. He's taught at Columbia University, New York University, the New School, Fairleigh Dickinson, and at Unterberg Poetry Center of the 92nd Street Y, where he is a core faculty member. And he's here today to talk about his most recent novel, The Fugitives. Hey, Christopher.
Hi, how are you?
Hi, good. Good to have you on. Let's begin by having you talk a little bit about The Fugitives and what inspired the book.
Sure. Well, the Fugitives began with the germ of an idea, which was, what would happen if a man, a white man, were to masquerade as a Native American? What would cause him to do that, and what would the consequences be once his story began to unravel? And there's kind of an interesting and familiar, I guess, point from which this germ of an idea germinated, which is that old familiar public service advertisement from the 1970s with the Indian who weeps when a passing motorist throws a bag of garbage at his feet. And, you know, I looked into it. I can't remember. I guess it's part of the availability of Wikipedia that you can actually check up on that sort of stuff, and discovered that that man, that famous and emblematic Native American, was in fact a Sicilian American from Texas who had spent most of his career as an actor playing Native Americans, and then as his career progressed, began actually to identify as one and become rather huffy if you suggested that he wasn't. And I thought that was fascinating, being partly of Sicilian descent, and also just because of the sheer fascination factor of the story. And so the book kind of took off from that single point of departure and developed into what it is.
That is so interesting. I'm also half Sicilian, and I love that story. Of course, a Sicilian would be offended.
Well, I think they're easy to offend.
And, you know, before we get into the book, although this is getting into the book, I love your author photo on your website. And after it's so funny. And after I saw that, I started looking at other photos of you, and they are all so different. And so I thought how interesting that was, that your novel is in part about identity. And you, it's like, who is Christopher, you know? Who's Christopher Sorrentino? There's all these photos, and you look different in every one.
That's me. It's for me to know and you to find out, I guess. I mean, the photos, I think one reason why the photos look so different is because I'm a very bad photography subject. I'm one of those people who freezes up. So the better photos of me tend to be the ones that are taken when I'm not aware that I'm actually being photographed. And when someone's getting me to pose, it's usually pretty disastrous. In fact, I, you know, maybe about 15 years ago, I just did a session with Marion Ettlinger, the famous author photographer.
Sure.
And, you know, she's a lovely woman, and we had a wonderful afternoon together, but every single photo that she took of me, I looked like I was ready for the embalmer, you know, and so I didn't end up using any of them, which I hope that she wasn't offended by it, because I really admired her skill. And I, as I said, I thought she was a lovely person, but I just looked like I had seized up.
Well, how did you pick the one that's on your website where you're sort of like about to blow out a breath.
Well, I kind of rotate the photos on my website because I want them to be kind of the anti-author photo. There had been one of me taking a selfie in the closet door of my daughter's dormitory room. There was one of me taken by my stepson sitting in a toy store brandishing a giant sword. And now I have the one of me with my cheeks puffed out doing my best Dizzy Gillespie imitation. And so that's, I think I just picked the one that kind of looks good, is actually somewhat flattering, and also doesn't have that kind of, you know, weight of the world look that authors' photos often tend to have. I would really prefer to have one that was, you know, in which I was smiling or talking, but I can't seem to find the right one.
Anyway, I love the pictures.
Thank you.
So The Fugitives, the story is told with multiple points of view, and I am always curious whether that's a plan from the start or if it evolved as you were writing and felt the need to tell another facet of the story that only a new point of view character could tell.
Oh, interesting question. In fact, it did not. I guess it's, the answer is sort of, because the first thing I wanted to do in the book was to punctuate it with the Native American stories that ended up actually punctuating the book. So that's one point of view. And then my original idea was to simply have it told from the first-person perspective of the major protagonist, which is this sort of dissipated novelist named Alexander Mulligan. And Alexander is a really interesting character. Sandy is his nickname. And I enjoyed writing him, but he's a bit overbearing. And once I got maybe 80 or 100 pages in, I said, anyway, I really need a kind of break. Plus, I'm starting to get the sense that he's a little more slippery, that the way that he phrases things, the way he's telling his story, isn't telling us the whole truth. So I invented a second character, which would be a reporter, Kat, who comes to investigate this the imposture of the Native American, as we discussed at the beginning. And her perspective was just supposed to be kind of relief from his, but at a certain point I decided that it would be interesting to contrast the two of them, to have them contradict each other, to have them have slightly different takes on the same events. And the rest of the book sort of unspooled from that point. The book developed an entirely different life instead of just being a straightforward account of this guy and his preoccupation with the fake storytelling Native American. It became a story of two and then even more people, each of whom were keeping secrets from each other, from themselves, and from us, the readers.
And then sort of turns into a mystery.
It does sort of turn into a mystery, and I think that was kind of inevitable, because one thing that I set up in order to set the story in motion was to put a crime at its center. And so I realized that I was going to have to, in some way, solve that crime. However, you know, I'd like to point out, and I've just been talking to someone else about this too, the crime and the mystery that unfolds as a result of it is really sort of a MacGuffin, as Hitchcock would have put it. I'm using the crime as a way of setting the characters and their various stories in motion. And, you know, the nature of it is more or less irrelevant. I really wanted to use it to explore all the other themes that the brain of the book is concerned with.
Like many things.
Identity and the sort of triumph of commerce, particularly as it has to do with the arts, you know, and other things.
Well, I'd love to hear you read from The Fugitives.
Sure. I'm going to read from chapter 10, which is when Alexander, the writer, and Cass, the reporter, whom he's just met, have repaired to a kind of coffee house where they're about to have lunch and their first real conversation, and I'll be reading a couple of pages.
Okay.
I directed the journalist to Gagliardi's, and let me just stop and say that would be the local pronunciation. I directed the journalist to Gagliardi's, a dusty place that smelled of coffee, cheese, and vinegar. Excuse me. She arrived before me. not having offered to drive me over, whether out of sensible cautiousness or because she assumed I had my own car, I don't know. I felt the vague embarrassment one feels over being a pedestrian in America, so I didn't push the point. In fact, I jogged over here as best I could down plowed side streets, arriving out of breath. We sat at a table with a piece of gingham oilcloth thrown over it in the place's back room, rumored once to have been a speakeasy that served Canadian booze offloaded from powerful boats anchored several hundred yards offshore. The ceilings were low and vaulted, and the room was dimly lit by old-fashioned sconces placed along the exposed brick walls. The place was an intimate trap for light and sound, and if not for the food, it would have been a perfect spot for a seduction supper. In fact, the only other patrons were a couple of teenagers teasing each other over the remains of their meal. As regarding her passing protests, he kept dipping his potato chips in her milkshake, bothering her in a way that made me recognize that even the most sophisticated flirtation was only maybe 2 degrees removed from this kind of blocked expression of primal interest. I hadn't ordered any potato chips. "So, the reclusive writer, like what's his name?" she said. Her own name was Kat. She looked very sleek indeed sitting opposite me, not in the regional chic that sometimes makes people from even the wealthiest enclaves look as if they've climbed out of a hay wagon when they step off a plane at Kennedy or Heathrow. All the more reason not to let her get away with casually feigning ignorance. "What's his name?" "Thomas Pynchon," she said finally. "Ah, well, I don't think Pynchon's too reclusive. He lives on the famously congested Upper West Side of Manhattan. Stalker Central, if the truth be known. You don't have to be remotely famous to have strangers become unduly interested in you there, to become an unwitting part of the street life. There are some things even gentrification can't quite kill off. And his wife's a literary agent. It's not exactly living on a pillar in the desert." "But no interviews, no photos, no appearances," she said. "Books, though. What more can you ask of a writer? Access?" "To what is the big question?" I said. Before I ever published a word, I thought how wonderful it would be when I finally got interviewed and had the chance to express all my brilliant ideas and opinions, to be famous. But it turned out Rilke was right, that fame is no more than the quintessence of all the misunderstandings collecting around a new name. Usually it's the famous who turn out to be the voyeurs, gazing into the abyss and wondering how to conform to its shapelessness, how to coincide with its needs and projections. That's not a writer's job. So it is. To avoid the argument altogether, the chimera of dialogue with your audience. Imagine putting all your faith in language only to discover that lots of people are just waiting for an opening where they can shout you down, tell you how wrong you are. Let them shout the book down. By then you're long gone. A novel should be like the calling card of an unknown killer. Who is this monster and what motivates him to do these terrible things? I don't want to be the youthful-looking author smilingly waving a reporter into his sun-splashed living room. She smiled at me, popping open a dark blue canister and shaking a nicotine lozenge into her palm. "But you can control your image. Only if you're preoccupied with having an image to begin with. You just want to hand an interviewer a copy of your book, and they want to know what you've got in the medicine cabinet. Is that what happened to you?" "Literally. And mindful as I was about wanting to stick to the subject of my work, I was totally caught off guard by the question." "You showed him?" "Her, yes. Dream of fame. And journalists don't really like reticence, do they?" "Most famous medicine cabinet in New York." She shook her head, pushed her hair out of her face. "For about 2 days, yep. Lexapro and Advil and 55 yards of minty-flavored floss. Big whoop. But what kind of write-up about a mere book can compete with copy dealing and lurid personal facts? A friend of mine made a casual remark to some guy who was profiling her about how her older daughter was having trouble in the third grade. Perfectly normal kid. Some brat in class was making her life miserable. You know how school can be. So the piece comes out and it says that she and her husband are deeply concerned about their daughter's struggles with a learning disability. They tried to keep it from her, but of course some of her classmates' parents saw it and grilled their kids, and the upshot is that the poor kid gets pegged for the rest of the year as the retard. That's literary fame. I get the attitude of a Pynchon after that. Just give them the book. Anything beyond that gets slippery."
Thank you so much. That was Christopher Sorrentino reading from The Fugitives, published by Simon & Schuster. And Before we go on, let me say that you're listening to KUCI FM 88.9 in Irvine, and the opinions and views that you hear and have heard on this show are those of me and my guests and not those of the University of California Regents. Okay. Love that section regarding pension. That is so funny. That was laugh out loud funny when I was reading it.
Yeah, I'm sorry I couldn't reproduce that experience over the air. I guess I'm the same reading aloud as I am taking photographs, just a little bit stiff. But please, let's go on.
So, you know, there's so much discourse about the publishing industry, and Mulligan, he's working on a novel, and he is so often disgusted by what's going on in publishing and has so many wonderful opinions about the industry. So as I was reading, I was wondering how much of Mulligan and even Salto is you?
Well, how do I answer that? Mulligan and I have a lot in common. Or I should say that Mulligan has a lot in common with me, but I don't actually have all that much in common with him. He's sort of an exaggerated version of maybe some of my worst tendencies, and also a kind of unfiltered consciousness that I don't really present to the world. And a lot of what he has to say about publishing are in very modified for form, excuse me, very similar to opinions that I hold, except as far as he's concerned and as far as the book is concerned, I've really exaggerated them for the purposes of satire. I've wanted to make everything in publishing that's troubling look absolutely out of control. And I've given Sandy Mulligan a kind of front row seat to it, because unlike me and 98% of other writers, Sandy is extremely successful. And one of the things that's bothering him about publishing and bothering him about his own relationship to it is that he started to feel as if this work, this art that he takes very seriously, has become nothing more than a commodity. And he's feeling a lot of pressure from the people in his life who are involved in his career professionally to produce, to come up with some more product that can be marketed and sold and can capitalize on his reputation and his fame. And he's not happy about that at all.
I love one of the sections where, I don't know if it's his agent or editor, maybe it's his agent, and, you know, he's like, I don't have a book, there's no book there, and the agent says, you know, just put something together and let them take care of it, let them figure it out and make sense of it, and it's so funny. There's just so many.
I'm not sure if it's gotten there yet, or at least I don't think it's gotten there for serious writers. I mean, I have to say, in defense of publishing, and my own experiences in trade publishing have been really pretty okay, you know, and I've generally found that when, you know, you as the author are not satisfied with the work you've done, or when you as the author are pushing back against an editorial suggestion that you find is inappropriate for your work, that the editors at commercial trade publishers are usually pretty okay with saying, okay, forget I said anything, mm-hmm, you know, and just continue until you're happy with it. So I'm not sure if anybody's actually telling, you know, the literary writers out there, like, forget it, just let them do it. But I'm sure there are some books where that happens, where the motivations aren't to put, you know, a piece of serious art in the world, but to put something that's going to, you know, sell by Christmas time out in the world. There's probably a lot of doctoring and rejiggering that goes on with inadequate manuscripts, but that's really a part of publishing that I have no experience with at all.
Mm-hmm. You know, I wanted to talk real briefly, since we only have a few minutes left, about the dialogue in The Fugitives. I found it so masterful, especially, I mean, there's a section from 79 to 81 that was just great, and so many sections like that. And as I was reading, I was thinking about you and wondering what your process is like in writing dialogue and if you read aloud.
I don't really read aloud. It's more like I hear it. And I have to say, I really appreciate your comments about the dialogue. But the funny thing about it is that I've got all these people in this book who are pretty much many of them are supposed to be from the Midwest. They all sound to me like New Yorkers. I think there's a kind of uninhibited way that that New Yorkers, at least traditionally, tend to express themselves, and that usually inflects a lot of my dialogue. I mean, Sandy Mulligan is supposed to be from the Plains States, and he's hardly laconic. You know, he's very expressive, very emotional, and so it usually tends to, you know, my approach to dialogue is to try to make it sound as if it's actually come out of someone's mouth, but at the same time to eliminate and refine it so that it doesn't actually have that that sort of hesitant quality that you might find in a court transcript or something like that. You know, my great masters for dialogue have always been Don DeLillo, mm-hmm. who I think is the finest living writer in America, mm-hmm. and William Gaddis and others as well, like Evelyn Waugh, for example, is just wonderful with dialogue. And that kind of very natural and conversational tone that you find in so much work is always really interested me a lot. And it's, you know, it gives you a lot of leeway, of course, because you can take things off your own shoulders or off your narrator's shoulders and put them in the mouths of others. So it seems like a really useful skill to refine and develop.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I didn't think of your characters as New Yorkers so much as, well, especially Mulligan. He's a writer, and so he would be expressive, and he would be, you know, all of those things apart from wherever he comes from is really how I took it, you know, how I took the character and what was coming out of his mouth. It just worked so well.
Bill, thank you so much. I'm glad you appreciated it, because it was hard work. You know, you come up with a page of dialogue that would take in real life, you know, 3 minutes to speak, and you spend, you know, a week writing it or a week refining it, and then you refine it again. And so you really sometimes feel as if you're working these people to death. maybe that's how it is for a theater director or something.
We are at the end of our time, and I wonder if, you know, if you have any last words or any advice for the writers listening who might be working their way through a novel.
Yeah, sure. I mean, my advice to writers is pretty generic, and, you know, I pretty much stick to the same template, which is to say, read a lot and take what you like from your reading and adapt it to your own work as you see fit, and try to think outside of the terms of the marketplace. You know, pursue what it is that's meaningful to you. You know, persist in what you think is beautiful. And you know, if you're any good, and if you stick at it, then that's really the only way in. Don't try and be someone else, and keep reading always.
Mm. Thank you so very much, Christopher, for being with us.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate the opportunity to talk to you today.
You're welcome. That was Christopher Sorrentino. His novel is The Fugitives, published by Simon & Schuster. We're at the end of our time. If you missed a good part of this show, this hour, it will soon be podcast, so you can visit penonfire.com. There you'll find other stuff going on, events, speaker series, other podcasts. So do visit penonfire.com. I'm going to leave you now. Thank you so much for listening, and you writers out there, stay in the chair.